Welcome to Coastal Cafe. I'm Ashley Blow, your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production between Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington and KPTZ 91.9 FM on the Olympic Peninsula. Today, we're going on a journey to a forest, one that's underwater. We'll be hearing from several voices this episode about seaweed farming off our coast and the Puget Sound. And we'll look into what that means for aquaculture of native sugar kelp, as well as restorative efforts for bull kelp.
In Washington State, there's only one other open water seaweed farm, and I plan on being the second. And so with that comes a lot of excitement, a lot of the startup positive vibes that go along with it. There's also a lot of challenges, a lot of things that, frankly, I'm kind of making up as I go along, but also getting a lot of help from people like you and organizations like Sea Grant.
That's Mike Springer of the Emerging Pacific Sea Farms talking to my colleague, Meg Chadsey, carbon specialist at Washington Sea Grant. And Meg's here to join us today.
Hi, Ashley. I'm glad to be back talking seaweed.
Thanks for joining us, Meg. What we just listened to was a clip from an interview that Meg and I did together with Mike. As you heard, he mentioned getting the seaweed farm together feels like a startup. But we weren't talking with him in a garage or a basement. We were in his speedboat. So, Meg, can you tell us what a day in the life for Mike may look like once he gets farming?
Well, for starters, it's going to be wet. I would say most days, even when the sun is out, because Mike will need to commute 15 or 20 minutes on a small boat out of the inner harbor of Vashon, down south towards Tacoma, and then around the corner and up a little ways into Colvos Passage, which runs along the west side of Vashon Island. Mike's farm, his crop, is underwater. And in order to check up on his crop and see how things are going, he's going to have to pull up those lines. So again, he's going to be reaching over the side of his boat, hoisting up some lines of dripping wet seaweed, and just generally being kind of soggy and wet, but he's investing in some good gear to keep himself dry. So the crop that he's growing down there on lines is sugar kelp. It's a native species, and it's happiest growing a meter or so beneath the surface. It's a native kelp, grows quite big. It's not the bull kelp that many people visualize when you talk about kelp in Puget Sound. Bull kelp is that species that has the big floating bulb at the top, and then it has long fronds growing out of that bulb. Sugar kelp is what's known as a prostate species, which means it sort of lies flat in the water, and it's not floating up there at the surface. It's neutrally buoyant below the surface. So about a meter or so below the surface, he's going to have sugar kelp blades growing out of a line that he has seeded with juvenile kelp. And then he submerges that line, hooks it up to his buoy system, and lets the kelp just grow and grow and grow from there. Another reason why Mike is going to be getting wet frequently is he's going to be needing to check his gear and also monitoring whether and how other species are colonizing his lines or his kelp. This is all part of being a good kelp farmer. You want to make sure that your gear is intact and in good condition so that you're not at risk of having anything break away and float away and possibly wash up on the shoreline somewhere, get tangled up in other boats or potentially even other animals. You want to keep your lines taut. That's something he's going to be checking frequently. You want to make sure that you want to keep an eye out for any invasive species that might sort of want to use his gear as a temporary home or a stepping stone that would help them spread around Puget Sound. He's going to be keeping a close eye out for things like that and making sure that those species don't take hold. He's also going to be, I'm sure, looking to see if species are using his growing kelp crop and his lines as habitat. Good species like juvenile salmon, you know, they love to hang out in the protection of kelp fronds. And I'm sure that since he's going to be working closely with researchers and kind of reporting what he observes as he farms to various regulatory agencies, he's going to want to keep an eye out for beneficial use of his farm and habitat by other species as well. So he's going to be going in and out of the water a lot. So all of this maintenance and this monitoring and this checking, in addition to just watching over, you know, the crop that he hopes to grow, harvest, and sell, Mike is really trying to be a good steward while he's out there working in these common waters. Like many other people who farm seafood in Washington waters, such as shellfish, he doesn't own the water. He doesn't own the submerged aquatic lands beneath his farm. Those are leased from the state of Washington through the Department of Natural Resources. And many, many other people also use that water. Most importantly, the local tribes who have rights to continue harvesting seafood and other resources from these waters. Where he's located, the Puyallup tribe has usual and accustomed harvest rights in that area. And so he wants to make sure that whatever he's doing in the water is beneficial and certainly doesn't interfere with other people's use of the water.
And Meg, we both know Mike is not alone in pursuing seaweed farming. A few weeks ago, you and Washington Sea Grant put together a first of its kind seaweed symposium. In one of those panels, we heard from tribal members and representatives of tribes, many of which have been harvesting seaweed since time immemorial. Here's a clip from Lonnie Grinnell Greninger of the Jamestown Sklallam Tribe. She is the tribal vice chair.
I tongan siam nischayacha siam, yuch siam snatch tiklam nus kayamsin, hatning sanatian satla, yait kui atian satla, man shot shortsin, manuite squatchy. A very good day to you all, honored friends and relatives. That's how we say in nus kayamutsin, or the Sklallam language, the language of the Lower Elwha Sklallam, the Jamestown Sklallam, and the Port Gamble Sklallam people. I would say that our relationship, so just Jamestown specifically, seaweed and kelp were always a part of our everyday life. So ancestrally speaking, we used kelp and seaweeds to line our cooking pits. So they were insulators to keep in heat, but also moisture for our clams and our camas plants, our prairie plants specifically, when we were cooking them for, sometimes days at a time, weeks at a time, they would be in those pits. We ate it on a daily basis or a seasonal basis. And we also used it as, you know, this was really interesting. I just learned this recently. We used bull kelp tubes in storytelling methods, like theatrical methods. And so as someone was on the stage in the longhouse telling stories, somebody would be behind stage making noises in the tube, you know, to add sound effects. It was pretty fun. So that was great. For when treaties were signed and when settlers were moving in and we were being removed from our lands, yes, these things happened. Some of our relationship with kelp and seaweed broke. And so now it feels like we're getting acquainted again. And we're learning what do we do with seaweed now? How do we reintroduce it into our diets? Because my generation, my dad's generation, and I don't think even my grandmother's generation grew up with seaweed in their diets as just an everyday thing. So now it's something that we have to reintroduce to our people. And so we're trying to do that with our traditional foods and culture program. We're trying to introduce through like kelp pickles, you know, so it's something, pickles are something that we understand now. And so try to introduce those ancestral vegetables back into our diets. We're trying that, salsas, things like that. And then we're learning how to harvest it all over again. One of the other things that we have tried to do, we had some momentum toward it. We were going to actually do seaweed farming under our net pens for native fish. And it was going to help with the, I am not a science person, so forgive me. I depend on my experts for this. Yes, poop. Kelp was going to help with the fish poop. Thank you. And we were going to introduce sea cucumbers under those pens as well. So the combination of the sea cucumber and the kelp. You know where I'm going with that. So we lost some momentum with that, unfortunately, when my dad passed away about a year and a half ago. But we have some more staff who are taking on that mantle, and we're just doing some surveys now. So we went back a couple of steps, but it's something we want to continue to do and keep growing in our relationship with seaweed, both for our treaty, but also for learning how to do it or deal with it every day. Although I will say that when I was a kid, we played with it a lot. We threw it at each other. We'd be running around on the sandy beaches, and we would run on it. We would play with it. We would take it and throw it. And, of course, you'd get those bull kelp, and you'd whip it around and hit each other with it. And not really safe, but that's what we did. We're growing is how I'll conclude that statement on our relationship.
The reintroduction of traditional foods through both modern and traditional indigenous aquaculture practices is happening across coastal tribes. Indigenous aquaculture refers to biocultural systems of management found in coastal places by native communities. These cultivated ecosystems are based on indigenous knowledge and place-based observations of the land and water. People who are not in tribes are also learning about introducing seaweed regularly as part of their diet. The more people learn it's a superfood, the more there seems to be a demand for it. As a market, economically, it's making sense. But it's also making sense environmentally. That's something you know very well, Meg. Can you tell us a little bit about why that is?
Yeah, seaweed and kelp cultivation can be really beneficial environmentally. And one of those reasons is because of the superpower of kelp, especially, which is the fastest and largest growing form of seaweed, to absorb a lot of carbon dioxide out of the seawater as it grows. That's what it uses to build its own tissues. So this extra carbon dioxide is in the ocean because we humans have been burning fossil fuels and releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere for decades, and that has been absorbed by the oceans, where it's actually acidifying seawater and is changing the chemistry of oceans, which is not good for the creatures that live there. And so when we can cultivate kelp, at least locally, where that kelp is being farmed and growing at a very rapid rate, some of that extra carbon dioxide can actually be pulled out of the water and reversing just a little bit this effect of ocean acidification. So that's a good thing. Another thing that kelps and seaweeds can do is pull excess nitrogen out of water. And where do we get too much nitrogen in our local waters? Well, it runs off of the land, you know, when we put too much fertilizer on our lawns or through farming practices that don't contain their waste. And of course, through all the sewage, treated and untreated, that is released into Puget Sound from our wastewater treatment plants and septic systems. There's a lot of nitrogen pollution coming out of that. And so people are thinking that cultivating seaweed can be a way to draw down that nitrogen and restore it to a more healthy level, and may even be a way of kind of preventing some of the microscopic algae blooms that also thrive on this extra nitrogen that are also doing harm in the environment. So seaweed can be a way to sort of steer that nitrogen into a more productive form, into something that we can harvest and use for many things, as well as eating. And recently, during that seaweed symposium, we heard from another regional kelp farmer and expert about other benefits that cultivated kelp can provide. This is Leanne Annis, and you're going to hear a clip from her talking about how salmon and other fish are actually using the kelp that she's growing as habitat, as a nursery. So let's listen.
So I'm across from Vancouver Island, and I have been cultivating kelp for fish habitat and restoration and now research for the last 5 years. I got into this 5 years ago with a kelp, an oyster farmer who had an existing aquaculture lease tenure, and he wanted to use his tenure to a better use because he was getting older and the oyster farming was hard on his body. So we got together and we got into kelp cultivating. And like my buddy Ted, who I hope will view this symposium later, I remember days when kelp was plentiful. I grew up on the north coast in a little village, Kitimat, in Haisla territory. I did a lot of boating with my dad. And I remember, there were passes of water that we couldn't get through. We had to turn the engine off because the kelp was so thick and sort of wade our way through passes. I later settled on the Sunshine Coast, raising my family in seashell territory. And there's a tidal rapids there called the Skookumchuck, or Seashell Rapids. It's quite a phenomenon where we have rapids of 14 16, 17 knots, incredible movement of water in and out of Seashell Inlet. And we're also located in some of the hottest water in the Salish Sea. So we're in a real hot spot. If you've heard of Desolation Sound, that's just up the coast from where I'm at. And the water temperatures are upwards to 2 degrees warmer than elsewhere in the Salish Sea, and that's a real problem for kelp. So I wanted to use the kelp farming practice for kelp restoration. It's the same needle, threading the same needle. So I had questions of how to bring the kelp back. I had observed the kelp decline in my area, and I knew when I stopped seeing kelp, I stopped seeing salmon. And I would rather have both salmon and kelp and rockfish and all the other animals that are intertwined in that food web back and have it, you know, healthy. So I took upon this practice of creating a kelp nursery and learning cultivation techniques. And I'm here to tell you that it is so much fun to cultivate kelps and put back kelp in the water. So I do really see there's lots of overlap between kelp farming, research and restoration. There's so many overlapping benefits to it. Also working with tribal members or First Nations to integrate traditional ecological knowledge. So the people who are living out in these remote places have the most recollection of what it was like before, and to try to return to some of those baselines of what was where and how it functioned years ago. We need to tap into that knowledge. So encourage everybody to work together to the benefit of restoring the habitat and having a flourishing farm, if you may, or whatever your interest is in cultivating. When I put kelp in the water every season, to my delight, the forage fish come back and spawn on it. I have tube snouts that lay packages of eggs every February, March. And Emily hit on the concern about forage fish, and we don't want to harvest those out of the water. But really what I've noticed is that they lay their eggs early and that it passes. They go through their incubation period on the kelp lines and amongst the holdfasts, and then they're gone. So you're providing a kelp nursery for those fish, and that's a wonderful thing. And it doesn't, I don't believe, impact the quality of the kelp. But I haven't had a herring spawn yet on the kelp. I know up in Alaska, Seagrove have had that experience. So the fish use the habitat early on, and hopefully the juvenile salmonids that are out migrating from the river systems and estuaries are also using the habitat. And let's see, I've also practiced a little bit of like spore bag placements. I thin my lines in the spring. I have Nereocystis saccharina and Alaria growing. With the Nereo, I pull it off the line in the spring, thinning it, and I've attached it to fist-sized rocks, and I've been able to plant out a mini kelp forest in an area that I know there's fewer urchins here than there. And so I've watched that kelp grow to maturity and produce source material. I've even cultivated the F2 off of that cultivated kelp. But I'll give a caution to preserving the genetic diversity of the area. Really important if you're going to get into cultivating that you practice knowing exactly where you're cultivating.
If you're just joining us on air, this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and I'm Ashley Blow, today's host of Coastal Cafe. We just heard a clip of Leanne Ennis of the Vital Kelp Project talking about kelp cultivation. I'm joined by my colleague at Washington Sea Grant, Meg Chadsey. She's a carbon specialist. We're talking about all things seaweed harvesting and cultivation in Washington State. In this episode, we've been visiting a recent seaweed symposium and what we learned there, but I want to take us back to Vashon Island, where we started the show with emerging seaweed farmer Mike Springer. Meg and I visited Vashon Island late last year to talk with Mike Springer, but we also talked to another Mike. That's Mike Collins. And he also has a seaweed project underway called Vashon Island Kelp Forest. While Mike Springer is approaching his seaweed harvesting from a commercial farming approach, Mike Collins is taking a regenerative and restorative farming approach. Meg, you certainly educated me on this. Could you explain the difference between the two for our listeners?
Well, I'll try, but truthfully, people are still kind of niggling about the various definitions of these approaches to farming. I'll start with commercial because that's pretty easy. We get that. Commercial farming is just like on land, where you're specifically growing a crop for harvest and for sale. It's you're trying to make a living as a sea farmer. And that's what Mike Spranger is doing at his farm that's on the south end of Colvo's Passage. Now, Mike Collins, whose farm will be a couple miles north, also in Colvo's Passage, his approach is different. And it's kind of, you mentioned both regenerative and restorative farming, Ashley, and I myself am still trying to understand the difference between those two terms that are commonly used, and it would be great if we had just an accepted definition. But they're different, they're both different from commercial farming in that there is an emphasis on delivering ecosystem benefits, on trying to improve the marine waters and the habitat in which the kelp is being cultivated. Now, like Mike Spranger, Mike Collins is going to be harvesting and selling the kelp that he grows, but he's not going to harvest and sell all of it. Part of his crop will be being raised specifically to hopefully seed the re-establishment of bull kelp, wild bull kelp populations that have been declining in the area. So there used to be much larger bull kelp beds on the west coast of Vashon in Colvo's Passage and also on nearby Blake Island. And he's hoping that the spores that are released from his cultivated kelp will settle in those areas where these beds have disappeared and maybe help bring them back. We're not quite sure what it is that's knocking down the wild populations, and we don't know yet whether cultivated kelp will succeed where wild has not recently, but we're going to find out. And I am hopeful that maybe it's just a matter of critical mass. If you can have a lot of kelp in one area producing a lot of seed, that will be enough to get a new wild population established.
Meg and I went to Vashon Island to record a video series on the two emerging farms on Vashon Island. You can go to Washington Sea Grant's YouTube page to watch them in full, but here is what Mike Collins described to us in his video.
Underneath the water here is effectively a forest that looks just like the forest you'd see above land. There's giant kelp and bull kelp, which are sort of the redwoods of the undersea canopy and forest. But there's 22 different kinds of kelp alone in Puget Sound, and it's one of the more diverse areas of kelp in the world. So we devised what we think is a hybrid model where we will raise bull kelp for restoration purposes and raise other kelp for harvest and cultivation and harvest. And we think that model is a unique model that's both financially self-sustaining, but also has huge environmental impact. What we will do is we will grow bull kelp on lines in the site itself, and we will leave it on the lines. And as its normal biological process, it will release reproductive spores at the end of the summer. And what we're hoping is that those will help to bolster the existing kelp beds north of here, near Blake Island and at the north end of Vashon. So we're just trying to help with a reproduction cycle of bull kelp in the area.
We're getting to the end of our show, and I wanted to end on something you emphasized in our video series on YouTube, and that's about community. You said for folks looking to become a seaweed farmer, they don't have to go it alone. From what I understand, the knowledge sharing in the seaweed community is very generous and thoughtful. What fosters that spirit?
Well, I think one of the contributing factors right now is that the community in Washington State is really small. We're quite chummy. And it wasn't that many years ago that you could literally fit everyone who was interested in seaweed farming in Washington for whatever reason, commercial, restorative, or regenerative, in a small room. And that's exactly what we did in early 2020. We had an intensive training for people who were interested in seaweed farming. And we actually had more people supporting the training than we had trainees. So it was probably only about 70 people at the time. And at the end of this three-day training, we'd been having so much fun and learning so much from each other. And we just wanted to keep the conversation going. Some of our early seaweed farming industry, like Joth Davis at Blue Dot Seaweed Farm, he's just so generous with his knowledge and, you know, is always open to partnerships and to helping out other people. And I think when you have examples set by people like that, others will follow. So that's the spirit that we really tried to foster at the recent Washington Seaweed Knowledge Symposium in December 2022. And that's what I'm going to be working hard to promote as the coordinator for the Washington Seaweed Collaborative going forward.
Thank you all for listening to us. This is Ashley Blow, and you've been listening to Coastal Cafe, a joint production between Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington and KPTZ 91.9 FM on the Olympic Peninsula. Washington Sea Grant helps people and marine life thrive by providing research, technical expertise, and education that supports the conservation of our ocean and coastlines. I'd like to thank our program director, Larry Stein. And as always, a special shout out to the band Kuweek for sharing their music with us at the open and closing of this program. Again, thank you for listening and have a good day. Ha